Privacy has been dead for 30 years because we can't risk it. Only privacy that's left is the inside of your head, and maybe that's enough.
Gilbert.
And I'm Sharon Gilbert, everybody, and welcome to the bunker. Honey, you sound so happy.
Well, it's a pleasant night here in St. Louis, just past 7 o'clock bunker savings time. And
April 26th of 2006?
Yes, 2-6 of 2-6.
2006, yeah.
Well, I guess we'll get one of those a month, so we'll kind of ignore it. Not significant.
Okay.
But we get to scratch the fluffy dogs before we put them down for the night. So it's hard to be in a bad mood when you're... You know, get a couple of fluffy dogs running around the bunker.
It is. You know what? If you guys ever need to just relax, come by the bunker.
But if anyone asks, they're fierce, ferocious Rottweilers with big, sharp, pointy teeth.
Yes.
Our security system.
Well, actually, Java doesn't have much of a tail.
That's true. But we get calls from, like home security systems trying to sell us on stuff. It's like, you know, we've got the best security system money can buy.
We do.
Yeah.
We do.
Eight legs and two sharp barks.
Well, it's snowing in Washington.
It is. It's amazing at this time of year when the cherry trees are in bloom, but yet it is snowing. Tony Snow took the gig for the president. And I was mistaken. Why did I think you worked for Nixon before? It was George H.W. Bush.
That's right.
You're right. He's not old enough to have worked for Richard Nixon. But he was in the media department, basically, in the White House previously. So this is not really a new job for Tony Snow, even though a lot of people, us included, kind of looked at this at first and went, huh?
I know. I'm still surprised he took it. There's more to this than we're going to hear.
Well, I suppose so. We both like Tony Snow and were kind of disappointed that he took the job because we thought that as a guy who appears to be honest and sincere, that he might have difficulty getting up in front of a press and explaining and defending the White House.
I know.
Because that's what he's going to be called upon to do. As a pundit, which they pointed out in the news reports today, he has taken the president to task for some things that he's done, both in his newspaper columns and on the radio.
But, oh, yeah. Called him an embarrassment. And his domestic policy was listless.
Yeah, yeah. So... we shall see how well he does in this job, because apparently he only took the position with the understanding and agreement from the White House that he would be able to give input into policy.
That's very interesting. We'll see how much input he really gets to give.
Yeah, yeah. It's like when he sits down at that first meeting with Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, and they're like, okay, Tony, go sit in the corner.
Oh, gosh. You know, he's... He could be in a bad position, sort of like Mahmoud Abbas.
Mahmoud Abbas, who is the president of the Palestinian Authority. Yeah, he really is in a rough spot. Since Hamas,
he's in a tight spot.
Yeah, since Hamas took over, basically, he has seen all of the authority that he had, which wasn't a whole lot anyway. I mean, he had a very, very... slender grasp on what was happening there in the PA.
On reality.
Yeah. And it, the only place he gets respect is in capitals of foreign nations, mm-hmm. which is why he probably travels so much.
You know, I think that's true. And he also, I think in his mind, he still has a little bit of clout with them because mm-hmm. some of the European nations have been saying, we're not going to send any money to the Palestinians right now because it's Hamas that's running the show, and we do not want to support terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, off and on over the last month or so, there have been a lot of Palestinian groups that have been screaming because, you know, the police are not being paid and, mm-hmm. you know, just various day-to-day activities that have to be paid for, and a lot of that money came from Europe.
Right, and now behind the scenes, it's coming out that the Saudis are quietly slipping money, you know, in the back door, and France is helping slip a few bucks. Mm-hmm.
Russia's
helping out.
Yeah.
So they're getting their money through back channel means, which is kind of what was going on the whole time that Yasser Arafat was in charge anyway. But Abbas has called for a Mideast peace conference immediately to call
emergency
foreign leaders together and to get them at the table. And I think this is just a desperation move by Abbas to try to reassert some authority, some control over what happens there in the Palestinian territories.
Well, let's just hope he doesn't go into a coma. As some leaders have
done in that part of the world. Yeah. Yeah, there's some odd things going on out there, but there is every day. That's why we have plenty to talk about, and we gather together over this
table down here in the bunker. Dearth of things to talk about. That well, you know what? Southcom, good old Southern Command.
The group responsible for defending the parts of America that aren't officially part of the United States.
Southcom, exactly. You know, you've got Northcom. Seriously, it just kills me. Northern Command, which shows Canada, the United States, Mexico, as if somehow they're all part of the same country.
Right, right.
And then we've got Southcom. Again, this is an American institution, part of our military, southcom.mil, and it shows Central America, South America.
Right.
As if somehow they've got rights to it.
Exactly. Of course, we've been acting that way for the last 100 years, 120 years anyway. But now it's just sort of... Well, now that it's on the website, it's official, I guess. So, yeah, the Southern Commander, John Craddock, is checking out reports that Venezuela is buying weapons from Iran. We talked about this a couple of days ago. Iranian missiles is what's been reported. So whether the report is true or not, the fact that it's being reported is significant because, as we've talked about many times, the stuff that gets into the mainstream news is the stuff that is cleared for public consumption. So... or sometimes cleared to for consumption in foreign capitals. Again, this could be a way of setting up the United States public for justification of some kind of action against, you know, Hugo Chavez.
Exactly. He claims that we're down there to take him out.
That's exactly what he's saying, right. And that's not well known among the American public, but it is true that we supported a military coup against Chavez just a few years ago. We tried to get, you know, to back the military in a coup attempt against Chavez. So it's no wonder he's cheesed at us. I mean, if I were in his position, I would be cheesed, too.
At least gas is cheap down there.
Yeah, well, yeah. What is he selling it for, like 12 cents a gallon? Boy, let's move to Caracas.
Well, I don't think we'd make a whole lot of money down there. Yeah. Maybe 12 cents a gallon down there is a lot.
That's true. It could be. Could be. Boy, you know, but there are things that are happening all over the world that, you know, do need to be... do need to be brought to the fore. One of the things that's happening domestically that hasn't gotten a whole lot of attention, and this is really kind of significant a couple of ways, a directive that was issued by the head of the FBI, Robert Mueller, in the summer of 2004, June of 2004. I just heard about this for the first time now, almost 2 years later. Apparently, one of the policies that he's trying to enact to shake things up in the wake of 9/11, you know, the post-9/11 world, is a requirement for field supervisors, FBI field supervisors with at least 5 years of experience are required to relocate to Washington, D.C.
That makes no sense. You want your experienced supervisors in the field.
You would think so. You would think so. They feel that by moving the most experienced field supervisors to Washington, D.C., they are somehow better prepared to deal with terrorist threats. It seems to me that that's exactly the opposite. Now, this story was published in the Miami Herald, and they pointed out that in Miami alone, there are 40 field supervisors that fall into this category. And that is a lot.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
That's like taking your really experienced captains and lieutenants and moving them all to the main headquarters.
Right. Now, critics of the plan have pointed out just what we've said. This is basically cause a brain drain. You know, all the guys who are experienced enough to handle the really difficult, complicated cases, because the FBI just doesn't do terror. They also do foreign espionage. They also investigate financial fraud, things that you need some experience to figure out. I mean, they have guys on the bureau that are just basically accountants, you know, who look at books and try to figure out who's got their finger in the till that shouldn't. You move all these guys out of the field into Washington, D.C., how are they going to investigate the stuff that's going on in, you know, Minneapolis and Seattle and San Diego? It doesn't make any sense. Now, try this idea on for size as we slip our conspiratorial tinfoil hat on.
It looks nice, honey.
What if the reason for moving the experienced field supervisors to Washington, D.C. is not to improve counterterror efforts, but to keep these guys on a short leash?
I'd say that's a very good observation, honey. Also, I think it would just add confusion in the field.
Uh-huh.
You'd have rookies, you know, that really didn't have a seasoned supervisor to look to.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds to me like it's intentionally sabotaging the whole effort.
That's kind of what it sounds like to me. Around the country, there are 980 supervisory agents with 5 years experience or more spread out between 56 different field offices.
Hmm.
And they basically have a choice. Either move to Washington, D.C., where the cost of living is outrageous, or become field agents, which means a pay cut of between $9,000 and $14,000 a year.
So now here's something that I'm sure you and I talked about this. We got an email about this recently, and the listener couldn't recall that you and I had spoken about it, but I'm sure we did. We talked about Rick Wiles when he was discussing the friend who contacted him about a possible event in the Capitol.
Right.
Wouldn't it be awful if there were an event in the Capitol and it took out a lot more than the Capitol building?
Mm-hmm.
And you had all of these experienced FBI people there.
Something at Quantico, then, where the FBI...
Or several.
Well, FBI headquarters. I mean, essentially FBI trains agents at Quantico, but yeah, headquarters
exactly.
Are separate.
FBI right. Headquarters is down in
D.C. Yeah.
Exactly. So you end up taking out a lot of your enforcement, your intelligence, your lawmaking, your accountability, your checks and balances.
Hmm. That would be beheading the agency, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would be awful.
It would be awful. And, of course, as you and I know, there is an alternative government set up that's just been in place for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
And the, way beneath, was it Denver or Boulder? There may even be more than one location. I'm not giving away any secrets. I think you can probably look it up online. But there are different locations where you can hide out alternative Congress.
Right.
Or an alternative, you know, judiciary.
Continuity of government sites. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So the United States would not cease to exist.
No, it would look different, but it wouldn't cease to exist.
It would look a lot different.
Yeah. While we're talking about the FBI, there's another story that you posted to WatcherMagazine.com today, which is the investigation of reporters that worked with the columnist Jack Anderson, who recently passed away.
Mm-hmm.
They've been trying to get into his files, his paperwork, and you know, basically asking his family for access to those papers. They apparently also want to know the identities of pro-Israel reporters who used to work for Jack Anderson.
That's what I find so interesting is that was leaked to the press, that specifically they're looking for pro-Israeli reporters' names.
Well, they've been investigating the lobbying group, AIPAC, and there have been several indictments that have been handed down in connection with that investigation, that these lobbyists were in fact working as spies for foreign government. And
what? We'd never do that.
Do such things happen? It is going to be interesting to see how that plays out because, well, let's face it, Israel does have a special relationship with the United States.
Yes, they do.
So it will be interesting to see how that plays out. Speaking of foreign relations with the United States, was listening to a podcast on the way home. Dave Emery, I've mentioned his name before, does a great program called For the Record. He mentioned a story that comes from the Telegraph in India about a month ago. It's a story that hasn't appeared in the American press anywhere that I've noticed.
Nor will it.
Probably not. Dateline New Delhi, March 12th. The Pakistan Foreign Office had paid tens of thousands of dollars to lobbyists in the United States to get anti-Pakistan references dropped from the 9/11 Commission report. The Pakistani Weekly, which the Friday Times is the paper quoted here, the Pakistani Weekly said its story is based on disclosures made by Foreign Service officials to the Public Accounts Committee at a secret meeting in Islamabad. It claimed that some of the commission members were also bribed to prevent them from including damaging information about Pakistan.
9/11 commissioners?
The 9/11 commissioners. The Keene Commission. James Thompson, Jamie Gorelick, you know, the whole group. Apparently, some of them were collecting money, taking a bribe? Yes. According to the report, continuing as I skip down in the story here, the lobbyists also helped Pakistan win the sympathy of 75 U.S. congressmen as part of its strategy to guard Islamabad's interests in Washington. Now, what struck me about the story when he was talking about this, well, two things. First of all, that there were Pakistani fingerprints on the 9/11 plot.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole nother story. We'll go into some other time.
Yeah, it's a long story.
Yeah. Point number two, though, which I thought was really significant, is that the 9/11 Commission report, which is the official United States government report stamped with the U.S. government seal of approval, was changed because of American lobbyists working on behalf of the Pakistani government. The official story was changed because Pakistan paid money, which in turn was paid to members of the 9/11 Commission, according to this story.
You know, here's the funny thing. I think most Americans, of course, our eyes are glued to the gas station prices.
Yeah.
We're not really paying attention to any other news unless it's something to do with Brad and Angelina Jolie. That whole story, don't even get me started on that. And if Oprah doesn't have it on her show, forget it. There are a lot of things taking place in Pakistan and India that really impact our country.
Mm-hmm.
And they very rarely make the news here.
Right. And I think that we need to pay more attention because a lot of what has happened before and after 9/11 revolves around that India-Pakistani axis.
Mm-hmm.
Why would we want to whitewash the official story on behalf of General Musharraf? Well, as you recall, the whole purpose for trying to get a foothold in Afghanistan in the first place was for the UNIKAL pipeline, which was to terminate in Pakistan. That was the market for the natural gas, trillions of dollars worth of natural gas coming from the Caspian Sea through Afghanistan. It all revolves around money. Yeah, it all revolves around money. So I thought this was a significant story. But what really griped me when I heard this story, what really made me mad was that here we've got these lobbyists who changed the official report on what we are supposed to believe about 9/11, the people who were responsible, and the reasons that it took place. The official report, the bipartisan commission, changed in order to benefit a friend, quote-unquote, of the United States. Meanwhile, there's a woman who is now being held at a medical facility in New York because apparently she tried to exercise her rights as an American citizen to express her opinion about American policy. Contacted a couple of people, one of whom happened to be her cousin, a position in a high government office.
Her cousin who is no longer in that office.
No longer in that office, right. Andy Card, the president.
Interesting that he stepped down about the same time that her case is
starting to come back to life. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is absolutely correct. So Susan Lindauer, who, by the way, was talked about today on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Greg Szymanski had his second hour devoted to Jay Fields, our guest tonight.
Mm-hmm. And Janet Phelan.
Janet Phelan was on there as well. And so if you missed it, go back to rbnlive.com. Look in the archives for Greg Szymanski's second hour today because they spent an hour talking about this case. Susan Lindauer may well, I mean, there is a chance that she may well spend the rest of her life in a mental institution being medicated against her will. Why? Well, not only did she speak up about American policy regarding Iraq after 9/11, there was a point that Jay Fields raised during the portion of the interview we played last night, which I think we need to reemphasize here because it's really significant. She gave a deposition in 1999, I believe, in the Lockerbie, the case of the Lockerbie bombing, Pan Am Flight 103, in which she came out and said that she had information that connected Syria to the bombing, that it was not Libya, it was not Muammar Gaddafi responsible for the bombing, it was Syria.
Mm-hmm.
because there were a couple of members of the American DEA on that flight who were returning from their office in Cyprus to the United States with information about the heroin trade running from Lebanon through Syria to the United States with the help of the CIA. So the Syrians bombed the flight. She gave that deposition. And it's very possible that that has something to do with why the government wants her quiet.
Well, you know, I think that's a great lead into the next part of our interview with Jay Fields.
We continue with our guest, Jay Fields, as we discuss the case of Susan Lindauer, former journalist and congressional staffer who is now, languishing in Texas. We had talked primarily about the events that led to her arrest and her indictment, charged with failing to register as an agent for a foreign country. But things took a strange turn before she went to trial, didn't they, Jay?
Yeah. She was hoping to go to trial for the longest time. They gave her a public defender up in New York. I want to say Stanford, I think is his last name. And I keep meaning to write the bar up in New York and say, hey, you guys need to investigate this guy to see if he's giving his client proper representation. Because to hear her side of it, he's basically a public defender who wants to do about the minimum and finds her to be pretty annoying and wants to do her no favors at this point. But she had a long list of people who could corroborate different things that she did, and some of them were overseas, and like the gentleman up in Canada, the professor up there who was reporter, and the attorney just didn't have much interest to hear her tell it and into talking to any of those witnesses, and depositions haven't been developed. And the attorney develops the idea, along with the prosecutor, that all of this language about her contacts in the agencies and all the things that she's done to try to end sanctions and prevent the war does sound pretty, pretty far-fetched.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he's kind of developed the idea that she was one of these people like in that movie A Beautiful Mind, you know?
Oh, yes. By the way, that is a great movie. But
so they go to the judge and they say, we think she's incompetent to stand trial. We think she's delusional. And he'd been trying to talk her into using that kind of a defense for some time, and she'd been refusing to use what she considered to be a Twinkie defense. She was proud of her work. And if there wasn't any error, anything irrational in Susan, it might be that she would attach more significance to her work sometimes than maybe it was due. I could say that, but I'm also thinking that when you're under stress and sometimes you repeat things that you were hearing, we didn't have intelligence assets in Iraq, in human intelligence assets. It was in the press in terms of how crippled we were because we didn't have assets.
Mm-hmm.
The notion that there was an American citizen who had the kind of access that she did, that we would not have been paying close attention to that, in my mind, is unacceptable. Even if we don't think she's 100% rational, there's still intelligence value from what we can learn from the encounters.
Yeah, interesting. And one of the articles linked at your site, published at National Review Online, took a slap at that idea and basically said, well, no, there's nothing that we could have learned from this sort of back-channel diplomacy, just to try to scuttle that idea.
Well, see, the thing is, you can distrust the notion of back-channel diplomacy, but even if what you're hearing is lies, there's intelligence value in trying to understand what it is that they want you to believe.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So the whole point of back-channel—the problem with black back-channel diplomacy is that it arrives at the desks of politicians who aren't skilled in intelligence analysis, and they don't know how to take the raw data and turn it into meaningful data.
That's a good point.
Corroborate it and all that. Or they don't have the assets that the agencies have. Okay. But this was different. She was bringing this information back, she claims, to people in the Defense Intelligence Agency and in the CIA who basically maybe didn't give her a lot of feedback. But they also, she tells me, made the point of telling her never to sign a non-disclosure agreement herself, just so that if she ever wanted to go public or needed to go public with any of this, she could.
That's interesting.
So my impression is that they left her as something of a relief valve in case they weren't heard. And now the information's out there. They weren't heard. But let's at least look at this and see that there was some evidence that not everybody in the intelligence agency was sound asleep, as some of the politicians like to portray it.
Mm-hmm.
I lost my train of thought there.
Sorry, my fault for jumping in there.
No, that's all right.
No,
you had only known her a short time, and she was arrested.
Well, I didn't know her at all at that point. I mean, she was arrested before I came here. She was arrested in March of 2004. I took my apartment here in November of 2004. She was free on $500,000 bail.
Mm-hmm.
Then she remained free and through the next year, and she made frequent trips to New York, and she attended, every so often, I think it was twice weekly, she went to pretrial counseling, and she did a good job of complying with everything that the court wanted her to do, and she was just coming up with the gas money to get up to New York. I remember one day she came and knocked on my door. I'd paid the rent, but she said, "Well, the electric company is here to turn off the electricity." I work with computers, and I couldn't have that, so I wrote a check, and because of that, of course, there were some other checks that didn't fit through my account a couple days later, and it's not easy when you don't have a lot of money, but I saw her struggling, and I helped her a couple of times get the gas money to head up there. And she's living very much hand-to-mouth, taking care of dogs to make money, but with her all of her appointments, it was hard to have a full-time job.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost, I don't know what more you could do to try to impoverish somebody, but she managed to prevent the house from being foreclosed upon and eventually made the taxes as well. But nevertheless, we had electrical outages. We had gas turned off. We had water turned off in the middle of the winter, you know. It was an exciting year. But somehow I just kind of felt like Providence had led me to her door, and I wasn't going to back out. And frankly, I didn't have the money to move. So about September time frame, her attorney and the prosecutor went to the judge and said, we both think she's incompetent to stand trial. The judge agreed to a four-month observation, that I guess the prosecution requested in Carswell Federal Medical Center, which is part of the federal penal system down near Dallas-Fort Worth. And she complied with that. They gave her 10 days to get her affairs in order, and told her to go to the airport and there'd be a ticket for her. She goes, she gets on the plane, she arrives in Dallas-Fort Worth and arranges for ground transportation to the hospital, and she checks in. They don't have a bed for her, so they put her in solitary for a couple of weeks anyway.
Uh-huh.
No telephone, so nobody's hearing from her. She eventually got to a phone. We did hear, but it wasn't like we could hear from her every day. It took some time before she could get to a phone. Then eventually they put her in the general population. And over the next 4 months, she says that she met with medical professionals there less than 5 hours.
You're kidding.
Nope, that's what she says. And I suspect she's telling the truth. Now, they would have certainly, in my estimation, found her to be an uncooperative person to meet with.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't have a real high opinion of the mental health professionals before she went in. And it was something that she and I disagreed with quite a bit. There's people in my family, and my debate partner in high school is a woman who has worked in the defense of people and works as a forensic psychologist, I guess it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I've known some very good people who were doctors in that profession, and she just would hear none of that. And I told her even before she went that I thought she needed to seek out her own medical help and get their own diagnosis and get herself onto whatever program they recommended, if there was one, so that when these kinds of questions came up, she could go and say, "Well, yes, but I've already been proactive here, and it has nothing to do with my case, and I was talking about my case."
Mm-hmm.
But she had a real, I think she's probably had some bad experience with counseling growing up. And I know now that part of her medical history was that she was diagnosed with, what's the disease? Epilepsy.
Oh, okay.
She was treated for epilepsy for a number of years, and my hunch is that maybe that wasn't a very positive experience. But and she's not taking medication for it now. I don't know if she is epileptic or not, or what. Her uncle had some concerns about that after her incarceration. I don't think the government made any efforts to get into her medical history, you know, as you would expect, competent medical. If you're looking at somebody's mental health, you should sure get the full.
Well, yeah.
Oh, exactly. The first thing you look for is an organic cause.
Yeah. So she goes away, and it's supposed to be a four-month observation, but 4 months came and went, and they didn't release her. And I think what they, and this is, again, from her, she's what they wanted out of that 4 months, and they would have let her go home earlier if she had agreed to take medication. Her impression was that the medication that they were prescribing would render her incompetent to participate in her own defense.
Mm-hmm. They were doping her up.
Yeah.
They wanted to dope her up.
Yeah. You know, when I look at this from, just at first glance, to me this sounds an awful lot like the tactics that, the Soviets used to use against their dissidents.
Yeah.
I'm just aghast that anybody in our government would allow such things that even have the slightest comparison to that, to even put our government in a position where they can be accused of that kind of behavior. It's just, that is...
It's so nauseating, isn't it?
It bothers me on a number of levels, and if we are indeed in a world where the government is going to be doing that to people that criticize it, then we got serious problems. I don't think we're quite that far along. I'm inclined to think that Susan offended some important people and they wanted to get her out of the way. I see this as something that strings of political appointees pulled. I draw a very sharp distinction in my mind between the world of political appointees and the world of the broader world of government that's conducted by civil servants.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fair to say in my own mind that I think a lot of the problems we have, we've heard candidates from both parties talking about the evils of big government, neither of which, when they come into power, ever limits the number of political appointees they bring with them.
Mm-hmm.
The one
That's
thing they could
point.
Control about the size of government.
Mm-hmm.
And my sense of things is that civil service was created precisely to attenuate corruption in government, the spoil system that we had before the civil service, and that while there are abuses in civil service, there are problems with civil service with people stagnating and not showing initiative and going to sleep on the job, that kind of stuff. That's a stereotype. In my mind, those particular evils serve as a counterweight to the evils you have with the political appointee parts of government, which may be a little bit overeager for some agenda.
A little too proactive.
Yeah, so I see this as another example of people in government who have designed things in the past, trying to put in checks and balances. You mix two poisons and you end up with medicine. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But we've been denigrating the career government employee so much that I think that the political people have kind of been given their head and abuses have followed. And that can be corrected. And I think that one of the ways we can correct that is by looking into our federal service and looking at those people who have been whistleblowers and giving the inspector generals that already exist the authority to reward points to whistleblowers that they can use in competing for future federal employment. So in other words, we've got to make it a little bit more fashionable for people to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm. Well, theoretically, during the Clinton administration, that was done, but of course that hasn't really helped at all, has it? I think people are more afraid to be whistleblowers today than they were prior to that.
Yes, and it's a strange thing where it's become so fashionable just to go along with the program and get your kids through college and get your retirement built up as big as you can. And people have forgotten what it means to be a patriot.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'd even say the same thing, and forgive me, I don't mean to offend anybody, but I'd say the same thing to Colin Powell. The guy's certainly had a great career. He was certainly a great general. But when he stood up in front of the United Nations, he forgot that there's a time when you need to stop being a soldier and start being a patriot. And when he went up there and told them that there were weapons out there and that he had the evidence, and sorry, whoever wrote that speech for him made him sound so much like Joe McCarthy. I have here the names of people who are...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. How many names am I going to give him? I think we're seeing that sort of patriotism coming out in the 8 generals that have spoken out against Rumsfeld.
Yeah.
You know, the retired generals that are really putting their maybe even their retirement paycheck on the line.
Yeah. Or so, well, actually giving up future raises, which would be significant. I mean, I understand. I haven't read the whole thing. There's question there. When you're in active duty, you need to some extent salute the flag just for good order and discipline, because you don't want everybody down the ranks, you know, making political decisions. But there's also, I think, a good tradition of people who are retired active duty who go on to be members of the American Legion. And by the way, I became a member of the American Legion because of Susan Lindauer.
How about that?
I would have never thought this, but a couple of friends of hers go to the American Legion on Friday nights for shrimp that they cook up. And I enjoyed the company there so much, and I went ahead and signed up. But anyway, what I'm saying is that there's a role for retired soldiers who are citizens to take a close look. The military has always been governed by civilian leadership, as it should be.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But I think as civilians, once we are, again, civilians, we need to be especially circumspect about how our civilian leadership is running the military. And we are in a position to do that with some expertise. And, you know, across the rank and file.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that is so great about American, is you've got ordinary Americans with experience. You've got that wisdom to draw on.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to make sure we are connecting the talent that's out there with these jobs. In other words, what I'm saying is the problems of this country have solutions. There are people out there that have the skills, have the knowledge, have the wisdom to solve them. And to some extent, it may mean tightening belts. It may mean changing our values a little bit and recognizing the guy with the biggest paycheck isn't the guy that deserves our admiration all the time.
I love what you're saying, but I know that there are listeners right now that are thinking, okay, we left her in that institute. She wasn't taking the drugs they told her to take. What happened to her?
Well, they didn't tell her to take drugs.
Misunderstood.
Wanted her to agree to a medication program in order to be let out.
Okay, we'll let you out as soon as you agree to start taking this drug, which Susan believed was a drug that would render her incapable of participating in her own defense.
Right.
And based on what you told us of the public defender in New York, she wasn't getting much of a defense to begin with.
True. Yeah.
So it's like...
It was the second public defender. They let her let the first one go, who was a specialist in landlord-tenant rights.
Okay.
Oh.
A little out of his depth.
Yeah, or her depth.
Her depth.
With.
Okay.
And, I don't know, maybe she'd have been better off with the first one. But, you know, Susan can be a hard person to deal with. She can be very demanding, and I don't doubt that a public defender would find her to be a nightmare. You know, on his legitimate and his limited budget, he's trying to get through the first few years of his being a lawyer, perhaps, and...
Mm-hmm.
And she can have some huge demands. Now, that said, her overseas contacts, one of them was the defense attorney for the Lockerbie trial.
Really?
Whoa.
Yep. That person, McKechnie, I believe is his name, called the attorney of Susan's on his dime and said, look, I will come there to testify at my expense.
That's huge.
I just don't understand how come this attorney can't mount a better defense with the kind of people that are weighing in for her.
Yeah.
I only hear about him from Susan, and maybe I'm too quick to see him through her eyes. Maybe he does see that, well, delays are important, and just let this administration get the heck out of office, or let their ratings fall. And then let's bring this to trial, you know, because, you know, there's an industry. This is another aspect that just came to my attention the last couple of weeks. There's an industry around government that supports the counterintelligence in a business of government. Okay, And there's all kinds of consultants that want to make a living off of, you know, providing consultation, providing seminars, developing tradecraft, training, this kind of stuff, of counterintelligence people. Well, they are seem to me to be very hungry for anything in the aftermath of the World Trade Center bombing that makes it look like they have any standing at all. And it appears to me that they have seized on the Susan Lindauer story as a showcase of one of their successes. Okay, so
sound like ambulance chasers.
Yeah, so it may well be that this is like the Tailor of Panama, you know. The government wants intelligence. There's people out there who realize the kind of intelligence the government will pay enough money for. They fabricate the information and sell it, and then that money, that information becomes the basis for going to war. It becomes a basis for prosecuting American citizens. And it's all justified because we are afraid.
Yeah.
We're afraid of little old ladies. We're afraid of peace workers. Now, that said, you know, Susan had a temper. She was very invested in making sure that the war in Iraq didn't happen. And she, when we'd see news accounts of American casualties, her attitude was, "I told them so," you know. And some of that wasn't acceptable to me or her other friends. But the truth was that she did tell us so. The truth was that we did invade a smaller country without provocation. Oh, I can't say that either. I don't agree with Ron. They were shooting at our planes in the no-fly zone. I think we could have probably made a pretty good case for invasion.
But, you know, Jay, you're entitled to your opinion, as Susan is entitled to her opinion.
Right. And it wasn't like she was telling them under oath that I will hereby swear to defend the enemies of the United States.
Right.
She was in an impassioned conversation with somebody who was trying to provoke her to get the information he needed to advance his career. And, you know, who knows?
I'm going to have you hold that thought. Can you hold that thought one more time? We're going to have to stop again for today. I know we have lots more to talk about. And, Jay, I got to tell you, she is so blessed to have met you. Because you really do, you know, defend not just her, but I think you're defending the very idea that the federal government cannot just come in and put people away for long periods of time without their day in court.
Well, that's what troubles me. Even if she were guilty, this is not right.
Exactly, and that's how we feel about it, too. We're going to have to explore that more tomorrow, Derek.
Yes, we'll continue our conversation with Jay Fields about the strange case of Susan Lindauer tomorrow on PID Radio.
That's part two of our interview with Jay Fields. We will bring you the third part tomorrow evening. And, sweetheart, I think we need to look for a tenant, somebody like Jay Fields, just in case.
We've got the dogs.
Rounded up. Yeah, but I'm not sure if they would talk.
I don't know. If you bring them a nice jerky treat, they're going to spill the beans.
Yeah. So anyway, we'll conclude the third part of the interview tomorrow night with Jay Fields and the strange case of Susan Lindauer. And, of course, we will put links to his blog where he's been keeping people up to date on the case in the show notes at PIDradio.com.
You know, one thing before we go, well, a couple of things. One is that our favorite comment is breaking up. She's breaking up. Schwarzman Wachmann 3.
Good old 73P.
Yes. It's breaking up, and it's kind of hard to tell. You know, I just watched Armageddon yesterday. Actually, I only watched the first 20 minutes of it because, of course, once you've seen the movie, you know the ending.
Right.
But there are things in the beginning that I find really interesting, and when it comes to, you know, just telling in advance, you know, programming us to believe things. But, of course, one of the first things it does is start to break up. Now, mind you, it's not a comet. It's a big asteroid. But it is sending out hurling rocks at the Earth in the beginning. And one of the things, of course, the first thing that happens is that the shuttle Atlantis is destroyed.
Right.
So, I hate to see that to happen to anybody, but I guess we'll have to see what happens with this. The other thing I wanted to speak about was this little story about English becoming the world language, the new lingua franca. French used to be the language of diplomacy, the language of commerce, up until just recently, even up until mid-20th century, mm-hmm. it was still very much French. If you spoke French, you were a hoity-toity person, mm-hmm. and you were accepted into all kinds of great restaurants. Now everybody's speaking English. Almost anywhere you go in the world, there will be some English there. Now, mind you, I sort of feel like here in the United States that it's Spanish that's becoming the main language, because everywhere I go, I think see things in Spanish as well as English. But what I find interesting about that is what we find in Genesis 11 is God says, behold, they are one people and they all have the same language.
Hmm.
And this is what they have begun to do. And now nothing which they purpose to do will be impossible for them. There's a big thing about having one language. Hmm. And, of course, we know in the last days that it is going to be a one-world government. So we are, even linguistically, moving toward that last day.
Interesting.
And, of course, with the Internet, it essentially is one world.
That is very true. And with 24-hour cable news, we now finally have the technical means for everybody in the world to see something happening at one time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when Christ returns and everybody will see him all at once.
Yeah, also, of course, when it talks about the two witnesses who mm-hmm. are lying in the streets of Jerusalem for 3.5 days and then suddenly they rise up because God calls them back home.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone sees it happen.
Yeah. Yeah, 24-hour cable news. You can just see right now they'll have a crawl. This is a Fox News alert.
Mm-hmm. They have an alert for everything.
That's true. That's true. I want to make a couple of shout-outs because we got some very kind words from some of the podcasters who are regular listeners here. Taylor, the Snarky Avenger at Snark Infested Waters. John, the Jesus Geek. And William G. Jones, Writing for Christians, all made some very kind remarks in their recent podcast about the interview with Dr. Craig Evans last week. And, of course, Dr. Evans did a wonderful job of explaining and putting into context the Gospel of Judas. So, in fact, young Mr. Jones said that he took the interview, took the three parts, and spliced them all together into one long MP3. He basically took the three pieces that I used when I edited the shows together and put them back together again and gave them to his pastor.
Like Humpty Dumpty.
Yeah, put it all back together again.
You know, that's great. That is so humbling to think that there are, seriously, that there are people out there who are using the shows that we put together in our little basement bunker.
That's right.
And they're affecting lives. And, you know, we do not take credit for that.
Absolutely
not. If that happens and when that happens, that's a God thing.
He just gave us curious minds and a willingness to pick up the phone and call people. And thankfully, there are people out there like Craig Evans, Mike Heiser, and others who are willing to give of their time. So
that's right. And we want to thank also everybody who has been giving not just their time by listening to our shows and talking to others and getting others to listen to our shows, but those of you who do support us financially. We don't talk about it very often, and we just, you know, we're not here, you know, drum and beats say please send now. That's not it. But those of you who do, thank you very, very much.
We do appreciate it greatly. We also want to take a moment to ask for prayer for our brother, Dave Duncan. He went in Wednesday the 26th, for some abdominal surgery, and we'll probably take him out of commission for a couple of weeks. So your prayers for Dave will be appreciated. And
Dave's also got some unspoken prayers, some things he's dealing with that if you could just really lift him up to God, mm-hmm. just say, you know, God knows what it is. God's totally aware of it. And we are, too. We just, you know, that's the thing with Dave, and we're not going to reveal that. If he wants to come on the air and talk about it with us, that's fine. But he does have some special issues he's dealing with right now.
Yeah. So we just thought we'd give that a mention. And Dave, we look forward to getting you back on to talk about the New World Order scam once again.
Yeah.
So. And meanwhile, if you have any requests for prayer, suggestions for us, comments, or anything, you can send them to our email address, which is radio@peeringintodarkness.com.
And you can always come to the forum and talk to each other. You know it's a friendly spot to be. Bring some coffee and donuts, and I'll probably show up. It's peeringintodarkness.com/forum.
Until tomorrow, I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert. Have a great evening, everybody. Bye-bye.
Gonna step up to the microphone.